a piece, we're going mainstream. Everybody's gonna eat, we're going mainstream. All my family is sick. See you on Main Street, we're going mainstream.
From Wall Street to Melrose Avenue,
we're going mainstream.
Venture capitalists to athletes to
we're
creators to the person who's collected trading cards.
Welcome back to the All Goes Mainstream podcast. Today's episode takes us inside the mind of a tech titan who's at the forefront of shaping the market structure evolution in private markets. John Stecher is the Chief Technology Officer at Blackstone. He's responsible for all aspects of technology across the firm and advises the firm's investment teams as well as acts as a resource to portfolio companies on technology-related matters. John and the team at Blackstone have invested in iCapital, Canoe, 73 Strings, LemonEdge, and many more. It's also his background in other areas of technology and consumer financial services that stand out and provide insights and lessons learned for how to build technology within private markets. Prior to joining Blackstone, John was a managing director, the chief technology officer, and the chief innovation officer at Barclays. He was also a member of the Barclays Technology Management Committee. Prior to joining Barclays in 2017, he worked at Goldman Sachs, where he held a variety of senior management and engineering roles across the firm's capital markets and technology divisions, and most recently built their Marcus-branded consumer finance division. He also worked at IBM, where he was appointed an IBM Master Inventor, where he delivered and created over 45 patents across several diverse problem spaces. John and I had a fascinating conversation about technology and how it's core to both building the business of Blackstone and the businesses they invest into. We discussed how Blackstone leverages technology internally and externally to create value, why alts are sold, not bought, why he sees the biggest evolution happening in the finance and accounting space within private markets, and what innovations are being built there, why the front office of private markets will still require human intervention despite technology advancements, why the alt space needs standardization, how product structure innovation, like evergreen funds, is driving technology innovation in private markets and companies that are being built to help solve some of those problems, how private markets are becoming more consumer-oriented, and how Blackstone is using AI to create efficiencies with their investment processes. Thanks, John, for coming on the All Goes Mainstream podcast to share your wisdom and experience of building core technology for capital markets and private markets. John, welcome to the All Goes Mainstream podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to have you. I think it's fascinating, A, your background, and B, to have the technology perspective on a podcast like this, because technology cross-cuts so many different things in alternative investments, whether it's the technology itself, whether it's how you invest as a firm. So we're going to get into all that. But I'd love to start with your background, because you have such a fascinating background. I'd love to hear how your past experiences have informed how you think about technology in both alternative asset management and private markets more broadly.
First and foremost, I've been kind of an engineer. I like to build stuff my whole life. And that was always what I was interested in from a kid growing up. Got into comp sci because it was one of those things. Computers were new back in the mid-90s. It was the Gateway 2000 computers, and they were all fun to take apart. And you had to actually play with dip switches inside of them. It was just super interesting. It was something that was nerdy and fun to do. And I felt like this is where the future is going at some point in time without really knowing it. But it was interesting to me. Did the comp sci stuff in college, which interestingly enough, I got an alumni newsletter from the University of Wisconsin saying that comp sci is now the most popular major in the school. When I was there, it was definitively not the most popular major. You had to be quite the geek out on technology person to actually go into comp sci and computer engineering. So it's an interesting juxtaposition over the 25 years since I've been there on school, on campus. Went to IBM, led a life of building low-level technology, working with actual prototype machines from our hardware manufacturing facility, building the Webster application server on top of that, playing around with prototype hardware from Intel. It was just one of those things. To me, it was the ultimate job for me at that point in time. It was a ton of fun. So what I learned from there was how to take technology and understand the very low level nature of it, how it works on systems, how internet connectivity works, how bandwidth works to various different places from Ethernet to satellite internet, and then how you build a system that is cognizant of all those things and is ultimately reliable and abstracts those things away from people so that they don't have to even think about it. Building that stuff was really foundational in where I've got to today, because I feel understanding how a system works is still applicable today, no different than it was back then. Then I spent time at Goldman, did a variety of different things, everything from building technology platforms, working on the marquee platform down there and kind of these securities division space, built two different products that we actually spun out. One is Symphony Communications Platform on the outside. Another one was bought up, think of it as before the iPhone had secure container to run email on, that was enterprise class. So we built one there, got spun out into a separate company, and then went to Barclays and was CTO there. So really saw a broad spectrum of technology and how it's applied to the commercial space as well as the institutional trading space. And it's interesting because every one of those thinks that they're more advanced than the other, but what you can see is they can all learn from each other in some way, shape, or form about how to continue to advance their technology platform and service their customers more. So that brought me here down the road. And I think if you grow up with a multidisciplinary approach to engineering, computer science, and ultimately meeting end user needs, it serves you well from the investing perspective.
I want to touch on something that you just said, which is this multidisciplinary approach and applying that to what you're doing today. I think one of the really interesting things, particularly as it relates to private markets, as we think about that evolution of market structure, particularly in the post-trade element of enabling more investors to access alts, which you at Blackstone have done tremendously well, is your background in consumer finance. How have you thought about the experiences you had in consumer finance impacting how you think about the UX and products for the end client in private markets?
I think everything in consumer finance, and I learned this in the Marcus days, and then we transferred it to Barclays days. And honestly, it was part of the core IBM days as well. Selling software to people, you still have to think about what's the user experience. Ultimately, when you back into, if we want to sell alternative products to end users and to high net worth individuals and other folks out there, it's what's the user experience for them? How do they go about discovering them? So they work through their financial advisors, typically discover them. They go off, read a website, and actually want to understand what does the vehicle do? How does it work behind the scenes? I trust Blackstone. I think that they've done a spectacular job of understanding the user experience for the FA. What does the FA need at the end of the day at a variety of different banks? So from Merrill Lynch to Morgan Stanley, et cetera, UBS. It's what are they driven by and what do they need to understand about the product? Taking that whole end user experience and thinking about the client first and then working back from there to the products that we build and the investments that we make, that's really what enables a lot more of the, I would say, the consumer side of alts to start to grow.
How do you think about that interplay between technology and distribution? Is one more important than the other? How do they complement each other?
A lot of the alt products today are still a slower moving market than like equities. So if you go to the far end and you're trading equities as an individual investor in the outside world, you care a lot more about the technology platform, like execution latency, time frame. These vehicles from the alt space are completely different in terms of their time. You invest in one, you expect to hold it for the holding period, which is multiple years typically, rather than being in and out of something fairly quickly or buying it around the ex-div date on something and then holding it for a while. People want their experience and what they look for in the products technology-wise is much more of, can I get to the material easy to understand what the fund does? What's its investment thesis? What does it invest in? What doesn't it invest in? Does that align with where I want to put my money? Is it diversified from my liquids portfolio? A lot more of the technology from a distribution perspective goes into that element today because it is just a much lower velocity product that we're selling. And a lot of it, the distribution, the guts of the technology behind the scenes, it ends up working through your traditional, like your wirehouse banks out there is how stuff is distributed.
That brings me to a place where when I hear that, I say, okay, alts are still sold, not bought. How much can technology change that?
I think what you're going to see over time. And there are products in the alt space that are much more liquid. There's REITs out there that own properties behind the scenes. There's a variety of things that are listed products that technology plays a role in underneath the covers. I think what you're always going to have is certain parts of any industry, they're just going to be longer latency, less highly traded products. What technology can do is put into the end consumer's head earlier the idea of, hey, I need to have alts in my portfolio. My portfolio is a 60-40 portfolio. It should have 20% of that 40% possibly be alternatives. Then it goes to a lot more of the marketing side of the fence. Why do you want alternatives? Which investment in the alternative space do you want? Do you want to be in venture capital? Do you want to be in infrastructure? Do you want to be in credit? Where do you want to be at? I see that as much more of the technology game. And inside of when I think of where does technology really differentiate Blackstone from other competitors, it's the investing focus game. How do you make our people as efficient and effective as possible? How do they get to see as many ideas as possible that they could invest in? Because the more dollar inflow you have, the more you have to deploy. Technology is core to being able to source investments and diligence investments as quickly as possible. I think that's just going to keep evolving over time.
So if we think about tech being applied to private markets, you kind of touched on this, how you think about it internally. If you think about private equity and the evolution of private equity or alternative asset management as a business, it's effectively kind of Blackstone's, what, 38 years old around there. How do you think about the evolution of technology being applied to a firm like Blackstone and what you do? And when you came in, how did you conceptualize that?
The alternatives industry is very wide. There's a vast array of products. I'll give you the mental model that I think of it is like private equity itself is like custom tailored suits. Every deal is something where we want to know the very deep details of the company. We understand the market really well. It moves at a much slower pace. And it's something that starts with relationships, builds into understanding the business, builds into understanding the market, and then continues from there. And the hold times are just longer. Real estate, more things are commoditized. It's not quite custom tailored suits from a product perspective. It's more like buying something from off the shelf at pick your favorite retail store. You can actually lean into technology a little bit more there, because if you're looking at rent rolls and you're gathering a bunch of data from things, the ability to use technology to quickly make decisions and say, property A looks like property B that we've had here. Property B is successful because of these four elements. Property A, if we do those things as well, will probably be successful. So it just helps with that a little bit. The bigger the scale of the platform that we have here from a real estate perspective gives us a lot of data to actually poke into and to derive these opinions from. And then you go to the credit side of the fence. Technology plays a major role there, market access and risk management and analytics around all the various different investments that we have and holdings. That's really where I would say the massive front of technology is here, because it's closer to the more liquid style products out there. If you look across the industry, like across financial services industry, this plays out everywhere. Consumer finance is the most liquid, most technology oriented, because your bank account, your current account or your checking account, you can see heavy use of technology, technology first, almost technology as the core underpinning to the business, to kind of custom tailored suits when you get into wealth management advice from your financial advisor, if you think of that kind of being the continuum there.
Love that. And where I want to go with this is, you talk about the continuum from consumer finance all the way to the private equity, custom tailored suits. If you think about the market structure evolutions that we've seen across different asset classes that you've had a front row seat in helping develop, you mentioned some of those firms that you helped build at Goldman. How do you think about the evolution of private markets, market structure? Does it start to look more like equities, fixed income derivatives over time? Or because, like you say, there's that custom tailored approach to certain parts of private markets, it'll never kind of realize the same market structure evolution as the other markets you mentioned.
I would break it up into multiple different areas of where technology impacts market structure, both like normal financial institutions like GS, Barclays, Morgan, et cetera, and then here. I think on the front end, if you're trading equities, what you're doing is you're looking at comps. It's what's the price of Oracle? How much of a delta is there? You put together the basket of comps, and then you compare and contrast the way things trade against each other. Then you do maybe a second order kind of analysis of like, all right, sales, product, yada, yada, yada. You go deeper. And that's a lot of what I think is possible with private equity. It's comparing companies up front and being able to get that first pass, like, is this a good sector? Is this a good company in the sector? How does it compare to others? Then it really is that deep dive into the company, because you're never going to own it for a short period of time. You're going to own it for a long time. You're going to want to actually improve it, fix it, and make it better than it was when you bought it, because that's ultimately how you derive and create value in the investment. It's a longer burn. It's a first pass screen that tells you, hey, good, bad. And then it goes deeper from there. We have a product called Atlas internally. Think of it as leveraged buyout screenings. It looks at all the publicly listed companies out there and kind of suggests, hey, here's interesting areas that we should be focused on, interesting companies that meet a first pass criteria. And then from there, it's legwork. That's deal origination. You can see that. You can imagine that on the credit side. You can imagine on the real estate side, all of these screeners with ever advanced sophistication there. And the front office is going to get where technology is enabling humans to source stuff quicker, to make higher fidelity decisions. But ultimately, discretion still goes back to the investment professional and their wealth of knowledge, the team that's pulling together stuff there, and your investment process. In your finance and accounting space, that's really where I see the biggest evolution happening here over the next 3 to 5 years from a technology perspective. The industry is filled with massively intelligent accountants that now, as more money funnels in, they're not able to scale. The world's not producing more CPAs at a rate that the industry's scaling. What you have to do is systematize stuff. Necessity is always the mother of invention. And so you're going to start to see a lot more technology come to the fore there. We've made a number of investments in that space with products from the early stage strategic balance sheet investing platform that I own here. We identify stuff that it's applicable across all the industry and say, hey, let's just use this. Let's put some capital behind it because we want to have really high quality software players there. So that's how I view that middle office area and finance area evolving. There's a variety of different platforms in that space that you can see coming to the fore. Then you get into valuation. So how do you value all these companies as well? That's something where you can imagine you consume a ton of data from every single company, and then you basically process that data, market as how it compares to competitors, and you produce a valuation for it. That's something that is automating rapidly. And again, it's technology coming to the fore, pulling in data automatically, scraping that data automatically, deriving the meaning from that data automatically, and suggesting valuations is kind of where you can see this playing out. Here, we have a product called 73 Strings that we're doing that with. I just see this stuff evolving very, very quickly over the next, let's say, it's not even 3 to 5 years, 1 to 3 years, where just because alternatives are going more consumer oriented, we have to mark NAVs on a monthly basis. You're going to see a heavy adoption of technology for people that want to produce those products.
So I think you hit on a few themes that are really pertinent to market structure and that evolving aspect of market structure, which is, you mentioned systematizing. And I think in the answer embedded with something like 73 Strings with valuation, standardization. How do you think about the role that standardization, and then my mind goes to industry utility, again, which you've seen in various shapes and forms. How does that play a role into where particularly the post-investment process impacted by technology comes to the forefront?
If everybody produced their financial records and their board books and everything in the exact same format, life would be easy. We could parse all that stuff. The reality is with a lot of mid-market, small market businesses up to enterprise class ones, we're all doing stuff slightly differently. And so there's always a need in there to have technology. The words are the same and the numbers are the same. It's just where they're hidden in all the documentation, and extracting that out easily is the hard part. That is what I think technology is great at, and what it's built for is finding and standardizing a bunch of disparate documents to extract out that data quickly, plug it into systems, give us the ability to analyze it quickly, and then make decisions from there. I don't think there'll be a heavy level of standardization because you'd have to standardize the way external companies across every nation in the world do accounting. It's just not going to happen. It's not like a publicly listed company that has, here's your SEC filings, this is exactly what you have to do, which was meant to drive standardization. Doing that for the massive amounts of private companies just isn't going to happen easily. So you're going to have technology do that standardization for you and then pipe it into your systems. I think what we've taken the approach of here is through the strategic Blackstone Innovations Investment Fund and then some of the other stuff we're doing is looking at where can we back industry utilities or industry like building block companies on the outside world. That's really where we've been trying to do the build versus buy equation in our heads is if there's something that's super proprietary and value creative to Blackstone, that's where I want to invest my engineers' time. If it's something that is a net benefit to the industry, that's really where I'd rather see a company on the outside pick that up, see some entrepreneurs be super successful building a company, building a product that we can leverage and use.
Do you think private markets is different and unique in that regard, that because of the way it's structured from a, there's large firms and then there's a whole raft of smaller firms, does that make the construct of how the market will work in terms of the industry utilities that are created, the types of companies that end up being backed by a lot of these large firms and having them as customers, does that make that different than other parts of financial services or other markets?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the biggest driver in my experience in the past of any type of standardization or utilities are really regulatory change. Behind regulatory change in the financial services industry, from MiFID to Dodd-Frank, you name it, there's a variety of platforms that people are like, this just makes sense to have be a standard. Let's just build a utility company on the outside. Same thing with trading venues. Instead of unilateral trading, let's just build an exchange where everybody can basically publish their best prices on the buy and sell side. We'll build an order book and go from there. That's typically where I think you see innovation like that. I think the alternative space is there's regulation comes in and pushes us down certain paths. My reference to 73 strings before and needing to actually produce NAVs on a regular basis and value stuff on a monthly basis, that's driving a change from humans doing valuations to machines doing suggested valuations and the humans then validating and checking those things from there and making sure that we give them the thumbs up and that everything's correct. So it's enabling humans to be successful and augmenting their intelligence. But that's really where I see regulation driving some of these things. I think competition drives the other bits of innovation. The want to win is why you go to the gym and push yourself a little bit harder every single day. The want to win, provide the best returns, drives leveraging technology around here more, hiring the best people, all of that.
You talk about standardization, particularly having an impact in the post-investment space. How much does that create more liquid markets in private markets, if at all?
I think it could down the road if you wanted to play it out. You could get to the point where if you're publishing the NAV of a fund on a regular basis, you could make it available for people to get liquidity from that fund because there's actually a published NAV and there could be markets created on there. I really don't know how it will play out because a lot of the funds, the idea is it is constant capital. It is something where somebody is committed to the fund for the life of the fund and they are vesting in the fund as time goes on. They're invested in seeing it be successful. Giving liquidity around some of the funds, I think, becomes a little bit of a future space that we're not quite to yet.
You mentioned some of the things that you think about at Blackstone. You talked about build versus buy. From an alts tech perspective, how do you think about delineating between the build, buy, invest decision that many strategic operators have to think about at a large company in the industry?
For everything that is a major platform, it's swim with the big fish. Look at like your cloud provider running on top of AWS or Azure or GCP. There's players out there that you can trust. They're going to be there. They're not going to go bankrupt. They're going to probably give you the best possible total cost of ownership for every compute second that you consume. So you swim with the fish there. Same thing goes with your office products. We use DealPath here from the deal professionals' perspective, like Salesforce. There's just certain things that I view are bedrock. They're across industry. You trust them. Maybe you can do a percent better, but the amount of money you're going to have to spend to do a percent better, it's going to be huge. So let's just use them. I then look at the next phase of it is, where do we want to build versus invest. So for those industry utility style things, like this accounting platform, LemonEdge, that we're invested in, we don't want to build a new fund accounting platform. It doesn't make sense for us to build a proprietary one. KKR, Carlyle, Apollo, it makes far more sense to like, let's back one on the outside, maybe even collaboratively with other folks in the industry, and let's see that be successful. Because then we create a great company, we have a better platform internally to actually run on top of, and ultimately we can lower the cost of running the firm in general. I would say we look at investing as if it's applicable across the industry, let's see what we can do there. Where I get into the build bit is really thinking about what gives us a proprietary advantage. So what can we build that's going to set us apart from all of our big competitors in the marketplace? And when you look at what Blackstone has, Blackstone has a bunch of immensely smart investment people. It has a plethora of data from all of the years that we've operated, as well as the sheer array of companies we own from a portfolio perspective. Being able to capture and leverage that is where we try to focus a lot of the engineering effort. This is everything from leveraging AI to leveraging actual standard data analytics, which still there's tons of value to be unlocked by just doing that, all the way to building some of these sourcing platforms that I was referencing, like Atlas and whatnot before.
How do you conceptualize your role as the CTO at Blackstone? Obviously, there's internal KPIs, I'm sure, and there's external KPIs, but how do you define success as to like what you're focused on both internally and externally is working?
My role is broad. I talked a lot about building stuff and doing things, investing, but my job is to make sure that Zoom works. It's to make sure that we can talk to each other via email and the phone. I look at it as like, it's a ramp up, like everything else in life, you earn the right to do the next thing. So you have to make the basic trains run on time that make the firm work. And the firm runs on email, video conferencing, and collaboration. That's one of the elements of the firm that I think is most unique. The sheer velocity of communication and collaboration of people around here is differentiated from any other place that I've worked at. Making all of that stuff seamless and work for people, key. Then you go to the next part of my job, which is my engineers and the teams that I have around here. It's focusing on a couple of key initiatives, which is centralization of data inside of Snowflake, because if you don't have your data in one spot, or one spot is kind of a theoretical, but one area that you can access, you really can't leverage it for nearly the insight that you can, or if it's distributed and kind of locked in silos behind various different applications, you can't leverage it very quickly and make decisions at a pace that it differentiates you in the market. That's something we're definitely focused on, having all of our engineers build stuff along three programming languages, just to make sure we can move engineers around and have them work on the highest priority projects. That's another big bit that I focus on. And then the last bit is cybersecurity. I spend a ton of time in the, you know, security space. Me and my CISO, Adam Fletcher, say security is everybody's business, because it truly is. The world is a scary place. There's lots of threats that we see on a regular basis. Have to make sure that we, you know, really have the place battened down as much as possible. So those three things are three core areas that I spend a ton of time thinking about working on. And then it's running the technology for each one of the business verticals, thinking about how do we build the best technology for credit? How do we build the best technology for private equity and real estate? How do we build the best technology for our finance platforms inside of the firm? That whole area as well. That's how I spend a chunk of my day. The other big parts of my day are really spent thinking about and helping our investment professionals and spending time with them, diligencing companies on the outside. So possible investments that we want to make, as well as working with portfolio companies, companies that we already invested in, to help them go through a variety of different technology transformations or cyber incidents that they have.
I think you bring up a really interesting point, which is that one, tech is embedded into everything we do, both at the firm level, but also at all the companies you work with. And then two is that technology is becoming so critical to investment processes. So how do you think about integrating with the investment team to know what their workflow is, what they do, and also for them to get feedback from you as to how to give each other more leverage and make the best investment decisions, if that's what your product is at Blackstone?
One of the things I think, and this was very clear to me the first weeks that I worked here, the investment process around here is truly multidisciplinary. Yes, you have insanely smart investment professionals, source the deal, structure all of the work around it, do all of the analysis of the company itself. But then they pull in people from a variety of different walks of life inside of the firm to opine on it as well. And since you said technology has kind of become the underpinning of almost every company out there, you have to diligence it and make sure that it is appropriately put together or run for the company that you're actually looking at making an investment in. Some companies, it's very simple. It's like they can run on the Office 365 suite. Everything can be kind of plug and play or click and deploy style applications because their business models don't require a bunch of custom technology or things being built proprietarily for them. All the way up to, we have other companies that are purely tech dependent. So we go to some of the ones that, you know, are public now, like Bumble. That's a technology company. It's a dating company, but under the covers, it's pure technology. And so super sophisticated, where the technology really being top notch is going to really have a big outcome on how does the business do overall. So part of what we do in the firm is pull in not just myself, but other experts on my team from various different areas, plug them in as part of the deal process and just get their opinion. And then we cross that opinion with strategic advisors from the outside. It might be CTOs or CIOs from other portfolio companies. It's trying to bring the best minds into the equation to make sure we get to the right answer.
When I hear that answer, it really feels like technology is becoming a major part of the front office of an alternative asset manager. It's driving investment decisions. It's driving investment outcomes. How do you see that evolving going forward, and how much more can technology create leverage points for you all as investors?
Start with the last question first. In terms of creating leverage for all of our investors, I fundamentally believe technology is an enabler for humans to spend more of their brain cycles doing the stuff they find interesting. And so that is what I'm always seeking, is how can I offload the minutia task? When I started here, John Gray referred to it as, I want the Emerald City from The Wizard of Oz, and whatever's behind the curtain, it needs to be an awesome machine that makes the city ever brighter. And that's the way I think of my approach to engineering over all these years has been, is everything you build, it's to make the person's life easier. It's to make them more intelligent. It's to make them be able to process more data. It's those things are what you go after. And that's really what I see technology, artificial intelligence, every other stream of it around here doing for our people. It's helping make them smarter and more attuned to the world around them, and then let them make the decisions. You know, I always use it akin to pilots flying planes, like the 777s and 787. They can fly themselves. They can land themselves. They can do a whole bunch of stuff. But you still want a really good pilot there to make the tough decisions when it comes down to it. And they don't do it alone. They do it in conjunction with all of the systems giving them feedback of what's the current situation.
You mentioned it, so I have to go there, which is AI. And I think there's a number of different threads to pull on with AI, because there's the internal component of how can a firm like Blackstone leverage AI. But you also have the collective intelligence from all the investments you've made, whether it's in AI. I think recently Blackstone has been in the news saying that investing in data centers, a large reason for, I think it was a $25 billion investment collectively into data centers, is going to be in large part due to more exposure to AI and what that can bring to both Blackstone and its portfolio companies. So how do you think about applying AI to everything that you're doing at Blackstone?
On the investment process, I credit the firm for being way ahead of the curve on the e-commerce boom. If you think of the e-commerce boom, basically begat the AI boom, because it started to drive a bunch of compute into data centers. Data centers became ever more relevant in terms of enabling more businesses to go online. There was significant growth in that industry. Then you just plop AI on top of that, and the need for power-hungry GPUs that take up a lot of space to now occupy the same data center space. You can see how it exponentially changed the growth of data centers across the US. Also, the growth of power consumption. One thing I think we've always done really well here is look at the full value chain from an investing perspective. If you look at the end outcome, which is you want to have artificially intelligent machines helping make decisions, what are the components that make that up? You would walk that all the way back to every possible industry it's going to touch. And data centers is one area where we have expertise in real estate, we have expertise in technology, makes sense to make an investment there. I think the firm was ahead of the curve. I'm looking at that. We've looked at a lot of other stuff across that supply chain as well. Software tools to get your data structured and in one place. All of the things to set you up to be successful from an AI perspective. And flipping back to just the AI space hype curve in general right now is, I think there is just bluntly a significant amount of hype in the space in terms of everybody thinks of it. If you read on X about it, if you watch some of the random news stations out there, people are way out there thinking like AGI is coming 2 years from now. And then all you have to do is I tell people, walk outside and look around. Evolution is a linear progress. It is very kind of step by step by step with new innovations every single year, compounding and creating a really cool outcome 10 years down the road. And a lot of the stuff you see on Twitter is the 10-year futurist look. It's not what's actually available in the lab or even available in practice yet. We've been on a march since I got here of centralizing data and getting our documents and everything else in areas that are easy to search and find and locate stuff. Then what you can do is layer on top of that a variety of different platforms from the Gen AI perspective to actually make interesting determinations or summaries of those data come to life for people. So enabling people to more quickly rip through board books, more quickly rip through investment docs, more quickly rip through credit agreements, all of that stuff, that's really the state of the art of AI today, is being able to process and summarize a ream of data very quickly and then turn it into human language. And I'm talking about the generative side of the fence. The predictive side of the fence has been around for a long time. That's really where we've been focused. We have this massive data advantage of all of the private data we have. It's, let's take advantage of it as quickly as possible. But I'm always trying to temper people of like, the technology is not what you read or see online. This is what it does today. Just pick up your iPhone. That's going to be state-of-the-art stuff out there. You can see we're not far off of where that, those applications are at.
You mentioned having massive amounts of data. Do you think that AI will benefit the larger alternative asset managers more than the smaller ones because of that fact?
That's my belief. You look at Amazon, what is Amazon great at? Pricing at scale because they have all the data. This is just a truism across every single industry and every single sector. I think the larger asset managers, because they have this collection of private data, they're going to have a bigger advantage for making the next best investment. But that's required because they have more capital to deploy. So it's like this self-serving machine that needs to keep working the right way. That said, all you have to do is walk down the street and look at the boutique clothing shops or the people that sell boutique unique sunglasses online or custom tailored suits. They still exist because they're hyper-focused on one very specific small vertical and they can spend all their time and knowledge there. And the data advantage doesn't nearly matter as much in those spaces. So I think you'll see both will still be successful, but there's definitely a lot of power in the bigger asset managers.
It's fascinating to think about that. A related topic is, I think we're seeing this play out with the larger alternative asset managers are really benefiting from their size and scale and the ability to work with the wealth channel in a way that others can't. I want to make sure we cover how you're leveraging technology to make it easier to work with the wealth channel at a firm like Blackstone, because you've been so incredibly innovative in that. So how do you think about leveraging technology to enable your team, both the investment side, the private wealth team, and the ops teams to all work with the wealth channel?
A lot of it is really driven through, once again, investing in companies and industry utilities. So iCapital is an investment that we have. It is the connectivity between ourselves and the wealth channel. And it forces you to standardize a lot of the things that you're doing in terms of the operational space and how you send people statements, documents, and all the rest of those fun things, how clients sign up for products. It's taking the pain off of us, which is something I would say, do we want to be innovators in e-signing documents and doing KYC of customers? No, we want to have other people do it because we have to do it at scale. We just want the best of breed, but we don't need to build it ourselves. We want to be innovators in structuring and building the best products that we can sell to people at the end of the day.
That does bring up a really interesting philosophical question, though, which is how much do you feel you at Blackstone need to own that client relationship with both the advisor and end client when you talk about using an intermediary or a platform or industry utility like an iCapital.
I think the industry utility makes it easier for people to consume the products. Why is it beneficial for their kids down the road? That's the type of conversation that you own with the FA and with the actual end client. I think for us, we spend a lot of time on that FA relationship, and it is still a very, very human relationship. You build it, there's trust involved there. It's something that you cultivate over time. As alts do go more and more mainstream, you're going to get into where it becomes much more of, it's not a liquid game where it's pick your best REIT or pick your best ETF out there, but it's going to start to look more like that. And anybody that thinks that that's not true hasn't really looked at history, which is like open outcry equity used to exist, no longer exists. There's not a machine on the floor of the NYSE anymore. There's TV screens, but trading doesn't happen there.
You bring up a really interesting point, because I think technology, as you mentioned before, certainly impacts the post-investment process and creating standardization there. But it's interesting to think how that aspect of things and making things easier for you, both in terms of cost and human capital requirements, loops back into product innovation. So how much is better technology factoring into investment product innovation? You've done things like BXPE, you've done things like BCRED, et cetera. All of that, I imagine, had to be leveraged by technology's advancements.
BXPE, BCRED have driven like 73 strings needing to exist here, because we actually need to value a wide swath of products on a regular basis. So again, necessity is the mother of invention. And it's one of those things like, we need to do this. What exists out there that we can actually leverage, or what can we build that allows us to do this? Goes back to the way we kind of started the conversation, which is thinking of the UX. What does the person on the other side need? And then walking back from there of everything you need to build, and then snapping together the Lego blocks to make that happen. Some of them you buy from, you know, another company, some of them you build yourself, but ultimately you want to build like the little perfect castle that just makes it all work.
What do you think is still missing from a technology perspective in the alt space?
I think the alt space in general trails the consumer banking space and your equities trading spaces, FX trading spaces, a little bit from the raw use of technology in terms of maximizing margins. There's a lot of cost, I think, that as people scale up, ends up being just document processing and a lot of nuanced things there. That's really where there's a big focus for my team, is how do we automate a lot of these processing things that we have to do inside of the firm? And how do we leverage best of breed solutions on the outside to enable us to do those things faster? Document scanning, document processing is a huge one. Just looking at all the companies we source data from to do valuations, looking at all of the various other different documents we source from a deal perspective, that's probably one of the bigger areas that I can see technology having a huge impact here over the next few years. But there's not really anything missing. It's much more of like leveraging of the tools that are out there in a different way. And this is always like any place I've ever worked, any business I've ever been in, there's the constant push and pull of, this is the way the industry's always done stuff, but this is the new way to do stuff. And you have to have that healthy tension to move forward.
Oh, it's interesting you say that, because if you think about some of those other market structure evolutions around equities or fixed income, firms had to come together to create some of those leverage points and some of that innovation. At Blackstone, you obviously leverage technology in order to work with the wealth channel, as we've discussed. How much is tech both a blocker and enabler of private markets working with the wealth channel?
It's a massive enabler as it becomes more popular and there becomes more want to integrate it into, you know, all types of various channels. You can imagine if you play it out, you have a bunch of robo-advisors out there now today. If alts becomes something where if you want to have your 60-40 portfolio, you want to have alts be part of it at one of those robo-advisors and you meet the criteria, you can imagine it just wanting to go off and programmatically select what do you want to include. I can see in the future those types of realities playing out, at which time technology and making products available is key to success, because that's the only way you really scale.
You mentioned the 60-40 portfolio. Obviously, that has changed. I think the industry now realizes that. But there's something in what you said, which I think is critical when it comes to enabling alts to become a larger part of a client's portfolio, which is, how do you leverage technology to seamlessly integrate both the pre-investment process as well as all the post-investment data into clients' portfolios so then they can understand where and how alts fits into a portfolio.
This is just me theorizing, so we're not actively doing this for somebody. But just like when you think of portfolio construction, if you go off to your favorite asset manager and you sign up and you log in, the first thing they ask you is, what's your risk tolerance? So you click through a bunch of things and say, what's your risk tolerance? How likely are you to withdraw the money if the market drops 20%? All the rest of those bits. You can imagine that driving, okay, here's the optimal portfolio construction for you with alts included. And today, it's literally equities and fixed income. You can imagine that sleeve sitting there. I think then you also have a lot that needs to go on with people understanding that these are not liquid vehicles. These are things where you're tied up for a number of years in most cases when you put investments into these types of vehicles, just because that's what leads to the, I would say, the more consistent and stable returns is that you're investing for multiple years, so you have a long-term time horizon. So that's where you can see technology leading an investor down to realizing, hey, alts make sense in my portfolio because I do have a chunk of money out of what I'm putting aside to invest here that is something that I'm not going to touch for multiple years. So therefore, let's go off and invest in it. And you can see there's a number of smaller alts platforms out there today in the real estate space and private equity space that are doing this more in the commercial, or the retail side of the fence, not integrating to the portfolio, but gives you easy onboarding and the rest of that.
What will it take to go from minimums that are certainly lower than they have been in the past, but to $1,000 minimums, $100 minimums, $10 minimums investing in alts? And we could argue whether or not that even makes sense, but what will it take for alts to get to that point?
Really, from a technology side, it's just a matter of you have to be able to service those clients and still be profitable. If you look at ETFs, ETFs used to charge much higher fees because running it underneath the covers, market access, technology, et cetera, is more expensive. As those things have commoditized, fees have come down and you've gotten to where you're paying next to nothing for, like a standard S&P index fund, just because that's the way of the world. So stuff commoditizes, gets cheaper over time. In the alt space, if you think of a $10 investment, there's going to have to be some profitability for every firm out of that $10 investment. Servicing costs and everything else would need to drop off and kind of make that work. And I haven't done personally any of the equations on that, just because minimum check size is bigger than that, because you have to be an accredited investor. You have regulatory change that would have to happen. And then you would also have the market need to make these vehicles profitable for people.
What in your mind makes alts go mainstream?
Honestly, it's people recognizing the fact that there's a lot of value creation that occurs in these instruments, and they're a perfect complement to the rest of the products you have in your portfolio. And so that's really what I would say got me into investing in venture capital years ago at first, and then getting into real estate, et cetera, is recognizing, hey, I have money that I want to hold long-term. It's stuff that in my own case was I don't need to touch for 10 years. And so where can I put it? That's not the standard channels, but is something I'm interested in and something that I know will yield good return. It was technology venture funds. So that was where I started because it was an area that I knew well. And that's basically, in my opinion, what makes it go more mainstream is people realizing it is something that people can understand the products. It's something that you want in your portfolio.
And years ago is probably a good time to be investing in venture, which segues me to question I always ask guests, last question on the show, which is, what is your favorite or most interesting alternative investment?
So all of my Blackstone investments, I'll say that just in general. My personal ones are just stuff that's very much into the technology space. I have personal investments just in a couple of companies out there that I find interesting that are problems that I've suffered in the past. One is dealing with how you apply for and pay rent in your apartment complex. That's the problem I had in the past. Something very simple like that. I also invest in a venture fund from my alma mater, University of Wisconsin, where they make stuff available and it's founders from the university. I believe in supporting some of the kids and folks that have come out of the same school, got the same education. Always good to support people that go through the same suffering / educational process as you. And then I think we do an amazing amount of really interesting investments around here. It's why I'm always proud to be part of the investment teams and do the diligence on them, because it's nifty to see all of the inside baseball.
You
talk about providing a window into what you do. You've provided such a fascinating window into the technology perspective on alts, and also how you link both the investment side and the technology side together in order to push private markets forward. So this was a fantastic conversation. Thanks so much, John, for coming on the podcast.
Appreciate you having me on. Hopefully everybody that's still listening got some good value out of this.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Alt Goes Mainstream. I hope you enjoyed it. You can read more about alts at my Substack, altgoesmainstream.substack.com. Thanks a lot and have a great day. We're going